Welcome to Triple Take, the podcast from AL.com, in which we talk to people about the books, music, and films that shape their lives. I'm Carla Jean Whitley.
I'm Edward Bowser.
And I'm John Hammontree.
Today, we're excited to speak with our colleague, John Archibald. John has been a reporter and a columnist for the Birmingham News and now AL.com for 30 years. He didn't really like it the first time we pointed that out, so we kicked him out of the room before we brought it up this time. But John is someone who I think we can agree we all respect quite a bit, both for his writing and for who he is as a person. And today he's going to tell us about how To Kill a Mockingbird, The Princess Bride, and The Mulligan Brothers have shaped him.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
Sir?
Till you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
John, we're here to talk about To Kill a Mockingbird, one of your favorite books and a book that has had considerable influence on you among many other people. Let's just start with the very basic question. When do you first remember reading this book?
I know I read it when I was a kid, but it didn't have that profound an impact on me until the late 90s, actually, when I read it as an adult in the Black Belt in Alabama in a little cabin without proper heat and air. And it was hot, and it was summertime, and I was reading by candlelight, and it all just came home to me, and I think I understood.
So about how many years would that be between that first reading and this sort of pivotal reading?
Probably 20,
and
22.
What were you doing in the Black Belt at that time?
Reporting stories about the Black Belt and about a lot of the issues that remained in the Black Belt, a lot of the issues that you know, could find in the book and were echoed in that place around me, you know, and on fields that were once plantations in an area that wasn't and still is in some ways haunted by issues of race and issues of class and issues of time. And it just seemed to resonate.
What was the experience like reading about a story set 60 years earlier, but seeing, I assume, some change, but, you know, you're also saying some of it not so different.
Yeah, I mean, there's change, but then there's that truth that comes and hits you in the heart, right? Mm-hmm. And that when I sit down and I read that book and I open it and it's talking about, there are several references, to Montgomery, to the church, to the Methodist church in particular, which I grew up in, and all of these things just made me feel like it was a part of me. Mm-hmm. And it's just all of those things. Many things change, but many of those things that we know in our heart don't. And I think that's what grabbed me most by it. And carried me throughout. The neighbors, the friends, the people, they could be related to me. They could be my people I grew up with. And I think that's why it's so important to so many people in this part of the world. Because it is as distinctly Alabama as any book could ever be. And yeah, it was 60 years ago, but that's what made us who we are.
Story. And I'm wondering if and how that has shaped your own work, your own writing. Obviously, neither you nor I are Harper Lee, but...
You could say that.
Yeah, I will say it again. Neither you nor I are Harper Lee, but it's hard for me to imagine reading To Kill a Mockingbird as a writer and as a writer in Alabama and not drawing some parallel.
Right. Because you know in your heart that somewhere you lived that. Some part of that you lived. And you can relate to, and the beauty and the genius of Harper Lee is to take that thing which we look at, whether it's the azaleas or the Lane Cake, which I didn't even remember until later, or all those little aspects of the crazy neighbors down the street, or the big thing of the trial and the racism and the historical oppression and all of those things, and say, wow, this is us. But then she's able to tell it in that way that seems not mundane and that is entertaining and is important and yet is us. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's the genius of it. Because I'm sure, I mean, you think about that, that's around us all the time. And it's just we aren't able to reach out and pick out what's so important mm-hmm. and make it so understandable to so many people, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking a little bit about some of the work you've done lately, writing some narration for a couple of videos in the past several months, one really recently. So much of hearing a story has a play on the rhythm and the words, and the language in To Kill a Mockingbird is so rich. I'm wondering if that or other works have guided you in that process as you've kind of thought through your own rhythms.
Well, I think any good writing has a rhythm to it. And certainly, I mean, every time I write something, and every time my wife kids me because I read really slowly. I'm a terribly slow reader. She can finish a book, and I'll still be on chapter five or whatever. But I mean, I think it's because it plays in my head every mm-hmm. time I do it. It plays out loud in my head, and I think that rhythm is so important. Whether you're talking about that Southern mm-hmm. rhythm, that is really, I mean, we have a lot of great writers here, and I really believe it's because the rhythm of our speech and the mm-hmm. rhythm of our lives and the rhythm of all those things, and it comes together in words that come out like, I mean, people talk about poetry, and I don't ever consider anything I do poetry, but I do want the words to come out in a rhythm. I'm a sucker for some alliteration and other devices like that, but I mean, it has to sound beautiful, and if it does sound beautiful, then people will listen to it, and mm-hmm. I believe that to be the case. And I understand from people that that's mm-hmm. the case. Beauty, of course, is in the eye of the beholder, but I think we have to make that effort.
Makes sense to me.
Well, it's that Atticus thing, too. It's just this myth of someone who can be better.
Yeah.
And that all we really have to do is to try to understand other people.
Okay, well, let's talk about your favorite movie.
Wow.
What is it?
Princess Bride.
Princess Bride?
It is. I waver between Princess Bride and A River Runs Through It, but when push comes to shove, it would be inconceivable for me to pick anything but Princess Bride.
See, to me, that's a movie that's clearly not like a Southern movie. It's not, but it feels like it should be because the characters are so rich and gothic and flawed. And unlike Atticus, nobody's truly untarnished in that one.
Well, there's some purity there.
I guess Buttercup is kind of pure. But, I mean, the main character is a pirate. Not well, just a pirate. He's Dread Pirate.
Right, but he stumbled into that career. Let's face it. He had the intentions of true love.
That's true.
Which caused him to go down the path into the Dread Pirate Robert's land. But he emerged. Okay. It may not be a morality tale in that point.
And it's also just so richly written. I mean, it's a writer's movie. And I think it came out right around the time that you started working for the Birmingham News. Do you remember seeing it for the first time?
I remember I had a great editor who I've talked to you about before named Randy Henderson, who was a great influence on my life. And he would come out with Princess Bride quotes for everything from Inconceivable to the land war in Asia line, which I can't remember right now.
Right. And I assume he used that you keep using this word. I don't think it means what you think it means. That seems like an editor's line right there.
Right. And frankly, I've used that in a number of columns. I realized at one point that I had used references to Princess Bride in a column every August for like four consecutive years. And so I had to have a Princess Bride moratorium.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
I mean, it is packed with great lines that are witty and smart and funny. And it has that adventurous quality that we all, when I say we all, well, many of us grew up with as kids, the whole sort of fantasy idea, pirates and kings and
right.
knights and all that. But at the same time, it takes you into a smart place where there are good jokes and there are good characters and, you know, evil loses in the end.
Well, and I think, you know, like I said, it was a writer's movie. I think it's neat that the whole thing is framed as a grandfather telling a story to his kid, to his grandchild. And Kevin Arnold just wants to sit there and watch movies the whole time, but he gets caught up in his grandfather's story. And, you know, as a writer on a news website, is there a parallel for trying to draw people into your stories?
Well, sure. If you can use, you know, it's long been my philosophy that if you can make people laugh, they will read things that they would not read otherwise. You know, and you can look at this whole Robert Bentley scandal right now. It's the same situation, and we've talked about this before. It's because people will say, y'all, you're tawdry, you're talking about sex and whatever happens behind the doors and all this. But the fact of the matter is, when people find something that accessible that they can relate to, they come in, they start paying attention to the other things you have to say, whether that's about the governor, whether that's about other politics or my cupboard or whatever the case may be. Those things that are universal to us draw us in. And those are, you know, they are things that have to do with sex and the tawdry things. They are humor, and humor is the one that runs the most.
Right. People have been telling these stories for centuries.
Right. And or just a good story, just a good tale, any device that helps people understand and makes them personable and palatable to them. I mean, I think it's like the sugar that makes the medicine go down.
Are you the storyteller in your house?
Oh, no.
No? Who's your storyteller?
Well, I don't get a word in edgewise. I mean, there are a lot of talkers in my house, and there are a lot of artistic people who like stories. But I would say my son is probably the best storyteller because he knows how to keep it brief.
Right. Did you read to your son when he was a kid growing up?
No, I read to all of them. Yeah, we sat around. We read the entire Harry Potter series out loud. We read the entire... It was great when they got to the age where they could read out loud, too. We were highly dramatic, though, I would say.
So you do voices?
I'm afraid I do occasional voices, which are probably incredibly offensive. But we can try one later on if you like.
Yeah, you know, I want to do Inigo Montoya, since we're talking about...
My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. Prepare to die.
It's pretty
See,
good.
I told you that's offensive. Good. It's offensive on many, many levels.
It offended my ears, I think.
It offended what, comedians really everywhere.
Okay, so if you were having to fight one of the main challengers in The Princess Bride, Fezzik, Inigo, Vizzini, which one could you actually beat?
Well...
You were an athlete in high school, so maybe you could do some fencing.
I can barely walk. You understand? So Fezzik is out. Sword fighting was not my game, so Inigo is gonna.
So a battle of wits.
Then. I think a battle of wits. I think I could take him on, not because I have the wits, but because I think his were vastly overrated.
Sure.
He has the arrogance to. I mean, he's like a politician in that he thinks he cannot be caught. And so I think I have more experience in dealing with people like that. All you have to do is sneak up on them and lull them into a false sense of security. And when they realize that, when they come to believe you're incredibly stupid, you have them right where you want them.
Okay, good. Now you're giving away all your tricks. Now nobody will be secure with you. Well, I think this is good conversation. I'll turn it over to Edward now.
Any other means, and they say everyone who's crammed on top this city's soapbox has leaped from it to their death, son. This I am sure, I'm no exception. I'm no exception.
All right, John, you have told me that one of your favorite songs comes from the Mulligan Brothers, Sensible Shoes.
That is true.
And
Alabama band.
Yes, and I want to just take a few of the lyrics and kind of go over them because they're so poignant, especially in 2016. This place is beautiful, the way it mystifies. It's bad, just like if Norman Rockwell painted a methamphetamine lab. They say everyone who has climbed on top this city's soapbox has leaped from it to their death, son. This, I am sure, I'm no exception. No exception. Now, that is like the ballad of the Alabama columnist.
Yeah, I feel like I live it every day. This place is beautiful, the way it mystifies. It's bad.
Yes, and that soapbox will kill you every once in a while. But the beauty of that are the lyrics that are very poignant yet very Southern.
They talk to me, and I mean, you can listen that whole song. It's you can obviously tell it's set in Mobile. It's set in this place where people are doing things that we can kind of understand, and then it speaks, you know, of that, of this place where we tend to make myths of things that we shouldn't. But in the end, you know, it's that sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that we continue to try to speak for it, and we can continue to try to stand up for it because we love it, and we often fail. We often plummet to our death, son.
Right.
But we got to keep doing it, so it talks to me.
But the Mulligan brothers really hit it because not only is it just an interesting metaphor, but there's simplicity in it, and I think that's why it really hits. Do you think in 2016 that we've lost the art of lyricism as far as simplicity?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm constantly amazed at the development of music. I mean, simplicity is great, but, you know, so is complexity.
Right.
And, you know, when you have the mix of all those things together, music is great to me because I don't know anything about it. I know I can't play anything. I wish I could. I can't sing worth a crap. My kids wish I could. But it's because I don't know it, it seems so magical and mystical to me. So that when it comes in and it talks to my heart, like that song does, like that particular line does, and every time it comes on, I will stop everybody in the room and make them listen to that line.
Right.
And so it's I don't know if it's complex or if it's simple, but whatever it is, it's a formula that just works.
Right. And I know, like Mike, me, you grew up in the Southern Methodist Church. I came up in Southern Baptist Church. A lot of those hymns over the years kind of stick with you because it's not fancy, but there's something about the passion, about the writing, right, that just kind of like pierces you decades later.
Right. And yeah, I kind of understand what you're saying about the simplicity now. It is that. It's something you could hear, you know, with a, you know, in a bluegrass band, or something you could hear with a gospel band, or something, I mean, or a gospel choir. It's something, all those things come together in that uniquely Southern way with simple lyrics that say precisely what they mean.
Exactly.
And it's not fancy, but it's still beautiful.
And do you think that art of simplicity, if we are losing that in as far as writing, because I love when that kind of comes over into the realm of writing, when we have things that are very plainly put in a beautiful way, but not overwritten.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the constant battle. And I think there's real value in that simplicity. And I would, on my better days, I would try to be that simple. There's always a kind of a conflict because you want to make things prettier.
Right.
And all the people I've looked up to all my life make things a lot prettier than I do. At the same time, there's real value in simply saying what you want to say,
right,
and getting that point across. If you can manage to get across in that simple way a message that still has a rhythm we talked about earlier, then I think that you've achieved some magic there, whether it's in song or in verse or in, you know, the print that we do.
Right.
So, I mean, it's still a thoughtful sort of idea. I mean, you have to think pretty hard to write simply and short sometimes.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you know my wife. My wife is an English teacher and also a writer by trade. And she will look at my column and be like, those five paragraphs can be three words. So just bring that down together. So as far as writing and songwriting, both kind of have a mirror of having a nice rhythm, as you put it. How can a writer kind of get that rhythm in their own works where they can be simple, where they can be engaging, but still their words flow and engage?
Well, that's the secret. Part of it is just what you were talking about earlier. In the most important part of writing is cutting.
Right.
And where, if we're losing that sense of simplicity, if we're losing that, as you talked about earlier, I think it's because we're writing, when I say we, I mean the world, mm-hmm, is writing so much faster now, because we're turning things out without, in different methods. I mean, obviously we're writing here to post for the internet now and tomorrow.
Right.
So we miss certain steps, and once upon a time I might read a column, you know, 30 times to go back and cut out and write to a specific length that I needed for a page. And it gave me great value to cut all those things out. If you have to write to a specific length, then every word is a precious thing. And so, I mean, I think that's part of it. But at the same time, people have to understand their own voice. And I know we've talked about this before. When you try to write in somebody else's voice, you assure failure. And it's only, and you can emulate them in the beginning, because we all do. I mean, I know that I tried to write like Rick Bragg at one time and realized only that I could not write like Rick Bragg, and it was a failure about to happen. So, you know, you learn who you are and you write your own voice, and it has its own natural rhythm, and that's the secret.
Right, you've got your own song to sing. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And listen to the moment, brothers.
Thanks again to John for sharing his stories. He is a great friend. He's a great mentor to us all. And again, he's a great storyteller.
I'm John Hammontree, and you can follow me on Twitter at John Hammontree and on Instagram at @BirminghamMontree.
I'm Edward Bowser, and you can find me on Twitter at @ETBOWSER.
And I'm Carla Jean Whitley. You can find me on a variety of social media at @InkStainedLife, or you can just look me up by name. That's it for this week's episode of Triple Take. We would love to hear your recommendations for future guests or feedback on the books, music, and movies that shape you. You can find all of us on any of those social accounts. We'll talk to you next time.